are you then a German citizen or you're still a United States citizen? The answer to that is that you can choose. You know, at that point, you can. The United States will give you up to 18 years to decide your citizenry.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So you can choose. But, you know, for the most part, American children who have kids abroad consider their children American.
Good. Well, yeah, because they'd be, you could say, born or naturalized. So that the naturalization process there, when it, you know.
Yeah, naturalization is different.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, the amendment says all persons born or naturalized in the United States. Mm-hmm. But then you could be natural. The kids could be easily naturalized in the United States through their parents.
Correct. And so, with that being said, none of us are constitutional scholars, but we will.
If there is anybody out there who thinks the 14th Amendment says anything other than what it says,
yeah,
please give us a call.
Give us a call.
Oh my goodness.
We want to know listening
about this comma.
And you can give us a call. Where can you call us at?
813-239-9663, WMNF 88.5 FM, The Urban Cafe.
Thank you, Prince. And you're listening to the Urban Cafe, like he stated. And so,
call us.
With that being said, I want to let's talk about duality of sorts.
Yeah.
So your most recent episode was a very fascinating one, talking about, again, reinforcing living in the gray.
Mm-hmm.
And my interpretation of what you were saying is basically ensuring that we see all parts equally, you know.
Sure.
And account for other people's opinions and try to see things through other people's eyes as well.
Absolutely.
Hold on, but before you do that, for the listeners who are hearing you for the very first time,
mm-hmm,
give them a quick summary of duality of sorts before you take that deep dive. Good. In.
Fair enough. I appreciate that, Prince. So duality of sorts is just it's a web series, a kind of short video web series that I do weekly. And it started just because there are so many things out there that are going on in the world, not just from a political standpoint, but from an international standpoint, from a cultural standpoint, all those things. So duality of sorts, just it's a platform by which I share things that I haven't heard yet. I'm talking about things that from a perspective that looks at different sides of an argument. And then, of course, I jump in with my super biased opinion. But I try to acknowledge that it's a biased opinion. I try to acknowledge all those things. So, you know, that's what duality of sorts is. One of the things we're promoting with duality of sorts is really focused on the polarization of our politics. And so what I'm promoting is something called working in the gray. And working in the gray is just an opportunity for us to kind of meet each other where we are. It's an opportunity for us to talk about what's going on with the state of politics, the state of community, from a perspective that acknowledges that there are power dynamics. It acknowledges that there are structures that benefit a small part of or a small subset of our community, but then it doesn't benefit all of us. So I'm pushing back against that and saying, let's all come together. But I do want to acknowledge working in the gray doesn't necessarily mean we're all coming as equals, right? Working in the gray for me means that all those people that feel disenfranchised, that have historically been disenfranchised, like poor people, like people of color, like women, like varyingly abled people, like
LGBT.
LGBT, Muslims, I mean, everybody. So it's acknowledging that they have never had power, right? So working in the gray is standing in the gray and saying, any of those people that are in positions of power that would like to just have an honest, open conversation so that we all benefit, let's come to the table, but at least acknowledge your power. At least acknowledge your power, at least come into the gray knowing that you need to spend more time listening than you do trying to own the conversation, because again, that's what you've done historically. That's not what working in the gray is. So for me, working in the gray is all of us coming together, having a conversation, but it really is about power dynamics, and it's about acknowledging the people that have felt disenfranchised and marginalized for years and giving them a bigger voice, and then allowing people in positions of power to come in and listen and learn and understand so that they can more equitably inform their institutions.
And I think we're headed to the midterm elections definitely started that change about representation. For example, the U.S. House of Representatives, the incoming freshman class that starts in January, is the most diverse group in the history of any election in this country. I'm trying to get some numbers here, but essentially it was record number of women. More than 100 women have been elected to the House of Representatives.
Yay,
that is fantastic.
Girls.
Absolutely. Yes. Congrats.
Obviously, including Alexandria Cortez. For the first time, we have two Muslim women elected.
Fantastic.
We have our first, and talking about the state of Colorado, elected their first openly gay elected official.
Yep.
Diversity is coming in.
It is. It is. The U.S. senator who won in Arizona, she is openly bisexual.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think little by little, what we're seeing is that transition, that transition of power, where there's been an overrepresentation of one part of the citizenship,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, for hundreds of years, that was what the population was. But now we're gearing more towards a racially diverse and populace. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it needs to be subsequently represented that way in the U.S. Congress and the U.S. Senate, which is overwhelmingly predominantly white male.
Mm.
And then that needs to change little by little, although there's a lot more women in there. And so and with that being said, I really like where we're headed towards this conversation. Anybody on the round table have any thoughts about what we're talking about here?
Yeah, and one thing that I absolutely love is that more and more common people are running for election.
Mm.
You know, my girl Ortiz up in New York, she can't even afford an apartment in D.C. until she gets until she starts her salary.
Mm.
So this means that there are more and more common people, number one, who are fed up of these multimillionaires running for office simply because they can afford it to just say, you know what, I'm just going to finance my own campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going to go in and run stuff. And my friends in corporate America, you know, they're now going to have my ear. They, you know, the lobbyists are lining up for me to consider legislation that will benefit them down the road. None of these multimillionaire politicians pay attention to the issues that are affecting regular working class Americans.
Mm.
It's always, it'll trickle down. You know, these benefits, the tax cuts will create more jobs. It hasn't.
No.
The tax cuts will create, you know, companies staying at home. How many times have we given corporations millions, multi-millions for them to stay in a certain area? You have tax cuts. You're not going to pay taxes for X amount of years so that you can stay here. And they take those credits. And within a couple of years, they fold up, close shop, and leave. And it's happened to Tampa on a number of occasions where, in one fell swoop, you've had about 300 to 400 people out of a job. None of these politicians care about those types of issues. It's the working class politicians that goes in who have felt that pain firsthand, who will benefit and speak for us, finally.
I hope they stay that way, because I saw, in the 80s, I saw a grassroots guy get elected, Frank Riggs. He went to represent our state, California.
Mm, yeah.
And he went there. He lasted one term. He didn't get reelected because he didn't do what he said he was going to do.
Mm.
Then he became a lobbyist. Mm. Then he switched parties. Then he was the guy who had the police open the eye of the protester and sprayed pepper spray in their eyes and made the press that way.
Wow.
So it was... He went to D.C. and he got turned to the dark side.
Yeah, wow. And that's how it happened.
So I hope it doesn't happen.
Right, and the thing is, what happens is you may come in with the greatest intentions, but your efforts that you want to put forth because you voted on, you ran on this platform, and your constituents supported you on here. Now you're trying to implement these policies, and you're met with resistance. And it's not just one. It's a concerted resistance, wall of resistance that you're facing until you acquiesce, until you come around. Eventually, they're going to come around.
Yeah.
And then, you know, support this bill with me, and then later on down the road, I'll help you out. And you're going to get that support from them.
I hope so.
And within your last 6 months of your term, period.
Well, I just hope that the people who sent them there keep on their case, that they keep on watching what they're doing, make them accountable while they're doing their duty. because that's what we need. We need accountability in our government.
And absolutely. So, some by the numbers here, so some of the stuff I was talking about, 13 of the newly elected female representatives in the U.S. House of Representatives are non-white. In addition, I forgot to talk about Sharice Davids, who is a LGBT candidate who won in Kansas.
Wow.
Kansas.
Wow. Yeah, the first LGBT candidate
look at Jamal.
Ever elected in the state.
Wow.
Jamal's eyes just lit up, right? In addition to Kyrsten Sinema, who won the U.S. Senate seat in Arizona, the first... it's been 24 years since the Democrats have had a U.S. Senate seat in Arizona, and it's a bisexual lady on top of that. I talked about the Muslim from Michigan, one from Minnesota. Two Native American women were elected to the House.
It's all nice.
For New Mexico and Kansas. Kansas has some very interesting trends in this election. Ayanna Pressley, who I actually heard speak, she speaks very wonderfully, is the first black woman elected to Congress for the state of Massachusetts. And then to wrap up the diversity conversation. Fantastic. About the female candidates who won for their House representative to be in the U.S. House of Representatives, Sylvia Garcia is the first Latina to represent Texas in the House.
Woo-hoo.
That's very interesting because you think of Texas, you think of a ton of Latinos and Latinas. She's the first Latina ever elected to the U.S. House of Representatives for the state of Texas.
And this, I got to add something real quick before we get this phone call. So I'm looking here at the Garden website. It says, the portion of Democrats who are going to be white men will drop from 41% to 38%, while the portion of Republicans who are white men will climb from 86% to 90%.
Which makes sense.
That's all you got to know.
That's interesting. So with that, we're going to jump to a caller, and then we're going to continue talking about duality of sorts. Caller, we don't have a screener, so please state your name and where you're from. You're on the air.
Hi, my name's Marla. I'm from Palm Harbor.
Hey, Marla. Good morning.
Hi, good morning to you also. Thank you for so much for addressing these problems and the situation that we have in the United States at this point. That we're talking about the 14th Amendment, about the oligarchy, about the corruption of our two houses of representation. But what hasn't been addressed is the Federal Reserve and how that's the backbone for all what's going on. And that was passed in 1913. It's the one that's funding all this dark money that's going in, that's corrupting our system and putting the United States into debt.
Wait, which one was this? For the Federal Reserve?
The Federal Reserve.
Okay.
It's December 1913 is when it was passed.
Okay.
And so what happens is we are printing money and we're also borrowing money to fund these systems because we do not have a capitalist system. What we have is a... almost a fascist system because it's the government that's picking the winners and losers in the stock market, in the corporate, and they're taking our money and they're doing it through corporatism and funding only specific companies such as GE and Walmart, which gets tax breaks from wherever they put their buildings. And we're seeing it right now, what's going on with Amazon. Amazon's doing the same kind of corporatism. The biggest company in the United States is taking corporate welfare. And the reason and how they're able to do this is through the passing of the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve is not a corporate, it's a corporation within the government that is private. So the citizens have no say in what's going on with that. Mm. And to go back to your 14th Amendment, you have the 14th Amendment where you have citizens... We have a say, but it is very important what that comma is and what the intent was in our founding fathers. And that has been misinterpreted because it goes back to the corporatism. So you have states like California where they're paying these exploited workers that come over here because our government has funded corn, which has exploited the prices of markets that has forced this immigration, and then they come into California where they exploit these workers and pay them under the table, which is unfair to people like us in Florida because we are paying into the Federal Reserve. We're still paying into the Federal Reserve, even though they're printing money and borrowing money, and that real money is being used to corporate welfare for the state of California, which exploits these workers by not going on the same tax laws as other states. And they use it by their educational system, English ESL, English as second language, which the Federal Reserve is subsidizing, and through where the people are walking into their hospitals and getting free medical assistance, and that's from this federal fund of the Federal Reserve. So it's all kind of like messed up because we're not playing under the same rules, and it's this corporation within the federal government that's it's a private corporation in the government system that is messing everything up.
And caller, your phone line's kind of breaking up. Everything you've been saying is fantastic. Is there any chance that you can call us back on a line that's not as interrupted?
Because we love what you're commenting on.
Yeah, you're saying some really important things. Thank you.
And so I want to allude to some. So the caller is talking about corporate welfare and so forth. The reality is that, yes, we do subsidize soybean crops. We subsidize wheat crops for ethanol production. Mm-hmm. A majority of that wheat is used for ethanol production, not for actually consumption. And so it's a very interesting conversation. We have another caller who's been on hold for a little while. Let's jump to that call, and then we'll circle back. Caller, you're on the air. Can you please state your name and where you're calling from?
Greetings. Good morning. It's Clay from Land O'Lakes.
Hey, Clay. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Clay. Good morning.
Good morning. So, you guys have touched on so many subjects and done so much. It's fantastic. It can't hardly keep up.
It's a lot. Yeah,
it's a lot for a Sunday morning.
Buckle up. Buckle up. I see you're in for a wild ride.
It's been that this morning, that's for sure. I happen to be on my way to our picketing of the Grace of God Church in Newport Ritchie, the ones that engaged in political speech while they were a polling station. We picketed them last Sunday, and we're going back again this Sunday. We're calling for the revocation of their tax exemption. We've actually filing papers with the IRS to try to get that done. But that's not why I called. I just figured I'd stick that in there.
Well, Clay, real quick, I mean, when you say you're trying to get them to have the tax exempt status reversed, who is we?
A group of a consortium of groups. It's the Four Peace Action Network. I think they're called something PASCA or Indivisible. There's another one. I can't name all the groups that are going to participate. But anyone can come down there. You know, we can't have churches engaging in political speech, especially when they're a polling station. You know, Brian Crowley, the Supervisor of Elections, went out there himself and asked them to take the signs down, and they refused. I was in the newspaper. It was on channel. It was actually just recently in the newspaper, in the local section of the paper, where they talked about whether or not they should have their tax exemption revoked, or that they did.
Well, thank you for mentioning that. I know that's not what you call, but thank you. Yeah. I wasn't aware of that, so that's why I was asking more about it. And Clay, what message do you have for our listeners out here?
Well, you know, when we talk about the Constitution, one of the things that most people don't understand is you have to go all the way back to the beginning when you want to talk about our Constitution and look at what our founders intended. And you can tell what our founders intended. That's how you determine what each amendment means. The founders had great communications between themselves, and they kept notes when they held their little conferences about their constitutional conferences. And all those things are in the Library of Congress. If you take the time to read them, you'd be amazed. One of the things that our founders didn't want, they were afraid of corporations just like they were afraid of a standing army. So they did not allow for corporations to be incorporated. You wouldn't just start up a corporation. You actually had to get one of the legislative branches of government to sponsor the corporation. Then it was for a limited time, usually 10 years or less, and it had to be for the public good. They never intended, and they were afraid of having corporations that were immortal. And unfortunately, we had capitalism that get around that, so that we have immortal corporations like ExxonMobil that will all be dead before ExxonMobil ever goes away. I mean, you know, so there were legitimate fears by our founders about what's happened today with corporations because we've become a corporately dominated society, and the greatest welfare our government gives out is corporate welfare. There's just no question about it. And I could talk about the Federal Reserve, but I'll just say one thing about the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is no more federal than Federal Express. It is a private corporation. It's a private bank is what it is.
Absolutely. And Clay, you're
absolutely. And one thing for you and the caller before, I want to kind of share something from my personal library. You may have it yourself. It's for the Secrets of the Temple, Who Rules America. And it talks, it's about an 800-page read, and talking about the Federal Reserve, how they make money, how they, you know, how their process of making money makes even more money. And it's written by Martin Friedman, I believe.
Right.
Milton Friedman. Yeah.
And it actually is that every time the Federal Reserve prints a new dollar bill, they devalue the dollar bill that's in your pocket.
Yes.
And, you know, that's economics 101.
Yeah.
So, one last thing, though, is when you talked about Governor Scott and his owning of HCA, let me say this about Governor Scott, because people keep getting so much wrong about this whole process. Governor Scott built, owned, and ran HCA. He bought up individual hospitals all over. He created one of the biggest hospital corporations in the country here in Florida. And they went and, through fraud from both Medicare, Medicaid, and some veterans programs, stole $17.9 billion from American taxpayers. Their fine was only 10%. It was $1.7 billion. And the reason that they never took them to task and got all the money back was because it would have destroyed the company. Now, when Rick Scott went and was being questioned in front of a grand jury, he took the Fifth Amendment, Fifth Amendment 72 times, and one of them was even for his own name. Isn't that amazing? I'm sorry. For his own name, you know?
I do recall that, yeah.
Everyone accused him of being an alien. Maybe he really is. And that's why he wouldn't say, yes, my name is really Rick Scott. But, I mean, it's absurd. And then he walks away scot-free. And
no pun intended.
He spends that money buying the governorship of the state of Florida.
But I do want to say, you know, the reality is that he's been the governor re-elected, actually, and now he's going to be the U.S. senator for the state of Florida, and it is what it is, you know. And so,
I would tell you the people who are most responsible for that is our mainstream media. They should have reported endlessly and all the time about the question of Governor Scott's integrity and about the fact that he ran this company to steal our money. You know, they didn't do that. They do a story and then they walk away from the story. But the entire time that he ran for governor, while he was governor, it should have been, you know, like a footnote. Every single thing you ever talked about Governor Scott was to say he's a criminal, unindicted criminal. That's just my opinion.
And thank Clay, as always, you have some very great opinions, some good facts. However, you know, we do want to say, you know, he was reelected governor, so he's governor of the state for 8 years, and now he will represent us in the U.S. Senate.
See, but that...
So now we have an unindicted criminal senator.
Pretty much. And I just want to say, for our listeners out there, that is Clay's opinion. And so, you know, many of us can interpret that in various ways. I know the majority of the people in this room lean one way. But, you know, the reality is that the state of Florida and his constituents have elected him to be our representative in the U.S. Senate. And the only way, Broward County kind of messed up, but the only way to not have him as our U.S. senator is in 6 years, vote him out of office.
Right.
But again, based on his record. So let's see what he does in the next 6 years for the state of Florida, mm-hmm. you know? So I know, you know, to his credit, after the shooting in the school in South Florida, he did pass against the NRA. He did pass some restrictions.
Because he was running for Senate. Mm-hmm. He did that not because he cares.
Mm-hmm.
Again, my bias is showing. This is... Yeah. My opinion is he did it because he knew that would give him a few more votes mm-hmm. that weren't hard stance conservative
yeah.
votes.
And he also saw.
He signed the gun bill. He didn't pass it.
That's correct.
Because all
he could have vetoed it
and then we got it
sure.
passed. Probably and it went back. Mm-hmm. So I think him vetoing it wouldn't matter because it would have got passed anyways.
But we don't know. The reality is that he signed it into law.
It was a smart political move.
Just like I was in Puerto Rico last weekend.
Strategic move,
correct.
Right.
I was in Puerto Rico last weekend, and so the conversation came up as like, who would be more beneficial for Puerto Rico, Senator Nelson or a future Senator Scott? And the reality is that both of them did a lot for Puerto Rico during after Hurricane Maria, to the point where, very interesting, to Claire's point, Scott visited Puerto Rico 8 times after Hurricane Maria. Why? Because he knew there were a lot of Puerto Rican citizens moving to Central Florida, Kissimmee, Orlando, Tampa, and so forth. So, some people, at least opinion articles in local newspapers in Puerto Rico, were stating, this is a strategic move for him, thinking about his candidacy for the U.S. Senate. And so he's a shrewd politician. I have to give him that.
But that is an indication of a broken system. Mm-hmm. That's not an indication of anything other than that.
Yeah.
Hey, I have a question. It's kind of off, but has anybody ever played the game Risk?
Not a long time.
But do you remember playing that? You play till you take over the whole world.
Yeah.
You use strategy.
That's funny. Yeah. So we have another caller. Caller, please... state your name and where you're calling us from.
Yeah, this is Zebulon calling from Tampa.
Repeat your name again?
It's Zeb. What's up, Zeb?
Zebulon.
I was looking forward to you calling in, Zeb, because today I was like, today is the day that Zeb can call in and shed some wisdom for us.
Hey, Zeb, nice to meet you. I haven't had a chance to talk to you. This is Joshua.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, there's a couple of things that I think are bright spots on the future politically in Florida. One is that Amendment 4 did pass.
Yes, it did. Woohoo!
I think that the bulk of us who are now going to be able to vote as a result of Amendment 4.
Zeb, can you remind our listeners what Amendment 4 was about?
Well, it restores voting rights to nonviolent convicted felons. So there's about 1.5 million people that are going to get their voting rights back starting January 8th when they open it up to register. So I think by 2020, you're going to have... hundreds of thousands of voters who are going to be a lot more progressive, perhaps, than some of the older, more well-off, politically entrenched voters that are putting people like DeSantis and Rick Scott in office. Plus, you always got to remember, every year a whole new batch of people turns 18, and every year a whole batch of senior citizens die off. And maybe that sounds cold-hearted, but it's the actual truth. And eventually, as time goes on, you're going to see this country go more and more progressive. It's already started happening. It was very obvious in 2016 that, 9,000 people came out to hear Bernie Sanders and 600 people came out to hear Hillary Clinton in the primary here.
And I mean, and I talked about the election results in Kansas, their first LGBT U.S. House of Representatives person, their first Native American in Kansas, which, most people, it's pretty... Republican-leaning state. So, yeah, I would definitely agree with your assessment of a more progressive electorate.
Yeah, the future is not going to belong to the oligarchs, and people are going to make sure of that.
But Zeb, the situation, so regardless of who's up for election and what the constituents vote for, the reality is that we have a set of laws that already exist and are on the books. So it's not just a matter of electing officials, but also making sure those officials are accountable to change, either amend the laws, create new laws, or rebuke existing laws that promote, what we've been talking about here about the oligarchies.
Well, the other thing, too, is that there's a lot of laws that are on the books that are not being enforced.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the main problems we have in this country, is that there are laws on the books that are not enforced, and it comes down to the judicial level a lot of times. The Trayvon Martin thing was a perfect example of that, how the whole process was stacked to try to make Trayvon look like the defendant instead of the victim. So, we have laws on the books that if they were actually enforced, you'd see a whole lot of these politicians in jail. But a lot of these laws are not being enforced. And, to me, politics in America has been so bought by the corporations that really it comes down to activism on the local level and people humanizing themselves. Because too often, especially if you're on social media, it's the big war of words driven by ideology, which feeds nobody, which houses nobody, which clothes nobody, which educates nobody. So we got to get past that and start dealing with each other as human beings. That's all I want.
Thank you.
Snap that out. Yeah. Working in the gray. Hashtag work in the gray. Thank you, Zeb.
Zeb, that was a fantastic call. Thank you so much. And we're going to switch to a break again. You've been listening to the Urban Cafe on WMNF 88.5. We got a variety of topics going on here today. When we come back, I'm going to read an email from John that we got in, and then we're going to continue our conversation.
WMNF's cool new app on your Android, iPhone, iPad, or any mobile device. And you can check out the Saturday Night Shutdown every Saturday at midnight to 3 a.m.
This is Roman of the Urban Cafe, and I would like to take this time to thank those of you who have called into our show in the past. Now remember that we welcome your voice, and it's better to call earlier than later to ensure that your voice is heard. The number is 813-239-9663. We would love to hear from you.
Welcome back.
Oh, yeah, man, how you doing? You good?
I know you like that.
Welcome back.
I know you like that.
All right. Again, good morning to our listeners out there. You listen to WMNF 88.5. We don't have the Facebook going today. We apologize for that. However, you can call us at the studio at 813-239-9663. You can also text us at 813-433-0885. And then you can also send us an email. And speaking of email, we actually have an email from John. We had a discussion talking a little bit earlier about the 14th Amendment. Prince has some very interesting things to say about the 14th Amendment, but he wrote a paper on it. And so John, it broke it out into two different things. Well, one, section one of the 14th Amendment, which again states all person born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, comma, are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. And so John's comment about this is, his interpretation is that this would mean any person born in any U.S. territory would be a citizen. I also think this would be a good argument for anyone born in a U.S. embassy, but not in a foreign hospital, which we had kind of talked about, right? Situation in Germany, possibly. He also says, if a foreign person on U.S. territory, legal or illegal, and has that person has a child, then that child is a U.S. citizen. Again, this is how John and the vast majority of the folks interpret Section 1 of the Amendment 14. Then he talks about Section 2, and his take on this is regarding the census. Very interesting. Section 2 of the 14th Amendment states, quote, "Representatives shall be apportioned among the several states according to their respective numbers, counting the whole number of persons in each state, excluding Indians not taxed." Again, because Native Americans are considered their own nations.
Right. They're.
And so, so John's commentary, or more like his question about this, is, why do the Republicans want to ask if you are a U.S. citizen on the next census, which has nothing to do with determining the number of representatives? And so that's fascinating. For those of you who are listeners who are not aware, there is a directive for the next census for 2020 for a question to be included on the census for the first time in the history of the census on whether or not you are a U.S. citizen.
Oh, that's
and
perfect.
I could guarantee you, the people who are not citizens, there are 100%. The people who are not citizens are not going to check that part.
Yeah.
They're not going to fill out the census, period.
Yeah. Exactly.
The key is to get the numbers in your... See, Republicans, for anyone who has not seen the movie Recount from based in Florida, it really just broke down the whole strategic position which is taken in matters like this. You know, because when I go to court, I represent quite a few individuals sometimes who... may have citizenship issues or in that process, and people are really afraid to go to court because of, you know, there's been situations in Florida where someone gets profiled, they get a non-valid driver's license ticket, And then next thing I know, they get sent to a detention center in Georgia. They got an immigration bond of $5,000-$10,000. Immigration bonds are 20%, not 10%, and they want collateral. So, you know, people have a very big fear of reason why not want to be in the court system.
Are immigration bonds state or federal?
It's federal.
It's federal. So the 20% is determined by the feds?
Yeah. Okay. It's not by the state, so it's different. But what I'm getting at is people are afraid of whether it be the court system, the government information, like a lot of people with the Dreamers, the recent, the DACAs, were really afraid to put their information out there. So this is just another ploy. I mean, they're always, it's pretty straightforward. Well, not straightforward, but it's pretty clear what they're trying to do if you really, really look at it. And I would want to ask, well, regarding the census, see, the question is, okay, if you don't check the citizenship box, but you fill out the census, would they just say, oh, well, we don't know, we can't really count that person, or...
I believe that it shouldn't matter. You know, I've completed a couple of censuses. You know, I've been living long mm-hmm. enough to complete a couple of censuses, and there were certain questions. I'm old school, you know. I remember... the ticket, what is that? The key punch that you put into the computer and the computer. Yeah, that's kind of
like the old school SAT or ACT.
Exactly.
You mean those cards that they had the little holes?
Scantrons. I remember working on computers from way back then.
They don't do Scantrons anymore?
I want to talk about the importance of the census. So, and this is straight from the United States Census Bureau. You can just go to census.gov. As mandated by the U.S. Constitution, America has just one chance every decade to count its population. Some of the things that that the census determines is how many representatives the state is going to have. There's a finite amount of representatives, and based on population redistribution, the coasts, the mainlands have been losing a lot of population, and that population has been moving to the coast, either the East Coast or the West Coast, and so forth. And so every 10 years, the U.S. House of Representatives gets redistributed on how many representatives. So, for example, the state of Florida will most likely have more representatives as a result of the next census. But why is it important to fill out a census? If a census is not filled out, that means that technically in front of the U.S. government, that person does not exist. So, therefore, this shouldn't count towards the populace.
This is the other thing, you know, the Republican strategy. Okay, so if you're going to count census amongst number of people, right? So Florida, California, Texas would have more representatives because people are there. Even though people can't vote, and they're going to at different places going to have more liberal representation. So that's why if I'm a Republican, it's always a strategy. If I'm a Republican, I say, okay, if I count all these people in Florida, because based on the Constitution, representation is based on their respective numbers, they'll have more people in positions in those Democratic areas, so I don't want them to count as many people.
That's true. Yeah, that's a strategy.
Even though they can't vote.
That's a strategy that they like to employ. Mm-hmm. You know, but the truth is that, you know, they get counted, and it is what it is.
And here's some facts again. This is according to the Brookings Institution. So the accuracy of the census will help determine also funding allocation. So it says here that for fiscal year 2008, 215 federal domestic assistant programs use census-related data to guide the distribution of $446 billion. So basically 31% of all federal assistance is a direct result of the census results. So depending, that allocation of money will depend on how many people filled out the census in your state. So if you put a question about U.S. citizenship on the census that didn't previously exist, to Jamal's point, you're going to have people not filling out the U.S. census, mm-hmm. and therefore the state will get less money as a result. Even so, there's less money for more people.
So think about how screwed up that system is, right? Think about the people who need the resources the most, I would argue. Mm-hmm. The people that can't call the cops when a crime happens to them. The people that can't find federal assistance in terms of food and housing and all those things. Think about those people that are the most marginalized in our community, and that's arguably, I don't know. I see it as the most marginalized. Those people either put on the census that they are not a U.S. citizen, and now the federal government has this idea of how many non-citizens are living in a particular community, which has implications on ICE and everything else. So they're putting themselves on the line if they put it on the U.S. Census. Mm-hmm. But then if they don't put it on the U.S. Census, the resources that they so desperately need might not come because they haven't identified themselves as an individual.
Right. And a quick question. I'm not sure if anybody here knows or anybody out there listening knows. So if you don't check this at, if you just leave this blank on the census,
will the census count?
Yeah,
it will
count.
When you turn in a census, you turned it in.
Okay.
It's whether or not you choose to disclose that information. I repeatedly withhold, you know, certain information right. That's not relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, because they take that information and obviously it's actually analyzed, it's parsed out, mm-hmm. And then you have other agencies that data mine that, and they come up with statistics. Mm-hmm. And for me personally, I'm just not going to give you that information mm-hmm. to use. You know, I just choose right. to withhold that information.
Right. It's like taking the fifth.
Yeah,
isn't it?
75 times.
So 75
times.
I think Clay corrected me. He said it was 72.
72.
So
okay.
72. I apologize, Senator Clay. Senator Scott. I apologize. I gave you
Governor
three.
Scott. Still.
Yeah,
still.
That's true. He's
There's
not
no
sworn
senator.
In. Governor yeah. Scott, I gave you three more fists than you deserve.
Now this may be for another day topic, but how does the census affect the gerrymandering?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, then that's very interesting too, and you know, goes back mm-hmm. to
and it still happens
and it directly
yeah.
affects.
I hope it. I hope that changes in the next yeah. 10 years, 5 years. Let's do it faster.
I also want to say, like, according to the Brookings Institution, again, to illustrate the fiscal impact of the census accuracy, each person included in the census in 2000 resulted in an annual addition of Medicaid reimbursement to most states between several hundred and several thousands of dollars, depending on the state. Mm. So something like Medicaid, which is a federally funded program through the Center for Medicare and Medicare Services, is also dependent year on census.
But we don't get a match in Florida because that's not what the governor wants, right?
Right.
Right, so it doesn't even matter. Thanks, Governor Scott.
Yeah.
Well,
thanks.
Thanks yeah. for nothing.
I want to talk. So we've great discussion. Thank you, John, for putting forth the questions about the 14th Amendment and the census. And so that's a very good tie-in. I like that.
Not to mention, still in the Constitution, very offensive. Oh, still in the Constitution is the clause that stipulates black people count as 3/5 of a man.
Mm-hmm. Kidding me.
That needs to be, that portion of the Constitution on that amendment needs to be repealed.
And that's
I didn't know it was still in the Constitution.
It's still in the Constitution.
You know, there's a lot of
didn't
one of our callers say there's a lot of laws on the books that,
yeah,
that
yeah.
don't we don't need or them Zeb, anymore, Zeb. And then there's other laws that people don't even know about that
yeah. mm-hmm.
they could use them if they need them.
So I want to talk about, in one of our callers earlier, we had back-to-back callers, and so we weren't able to discuss a little more about the Federal Reserve commentaries and about some of the subsidies. So just, you know, so we can have a fair balance, I on the Heritage website, the Heritage is a right-leaning institution. They're a not-for-profit organization. And so they published a report a few years ago now talking about farm subsidies. And their takeaways on this report, according to the Heritage Foundation website, are farm subsidies are intended to alleviate farmer poverty. But the majority of subsidies go to commercial farms with net worth of nearly $2 million.
Ooh, yeah.
They are also falsely promoted as saving the family farm and protecting the food supply. In reality, they are America's largest corporate welfare program. And the third takeaway from this report, again, published by the Heritage Foundation, a right-leaning organization,
yeah.
The third takeaway from this report was U.S. farm policies burden American families with higher taxes and higher food prices, which I think is, these are all things that the caller mentioned on their call. When we talk about the Federal Reserve, we were talking about farm subsidies. And so even the Heritage Foundation, which is on the right side of the spectrum, they also agree that farm subsidies are a little out of control, so mm-hmm. to speak, right? And it's and we're paying for these as
crops to go bad.
Yeah, crops to go bad. Yeah, you know, so it's a very interesting conversation about farm subsidies or soy subsidies or any type of
No, we gotta get a farmer in here, like someone.
Yeah.
Orange groves. What else? What else does Florida produce a lot
strawberries.
Of? Strawberries. Oh, Plant City.
Famous for strawberries.
Plant City.
I didn't start liking strawberries until I went to the Strawberry Festival.
Oh man. It's pretty cool actually.
Yeah, I want to learn more about Florida, Florida's agriculture and the future of that, and then they could probably talk about, you know, whether they receive some of these subsidies or not.
And this is so I'm really enjoying this conversation because I you know we're talking about. We had a gentleman on from the economic. What was his?
That was Bruce from Refuge St. Pete Economic Human Rights.
And so hopefully we'll be able to engage him a little more. I agree. We need to bring somebody on to represent the farming industry and talk a little bit more about what it is to be a farmer in the United States today. You know, so I didn't grow up on a farm. I don't know what it is, and I know that the average. Age of a farmer in the United States is 59.
Wow.
And so, and they're not churning out younger and younger farmers because there's just the margins are so slim. And because of climate change, it's just becoming more and more difficult to be a farmer. And so I would, yeah.
There's all kinds of things. They've got the thing with the seeds that they don't
regenerate.
Because Monsanto has made it so that they're all altered. Then you have to buy your seeds every year.
Yeah, we really need to have at some point in time a discussion on what's
food?
Frankenfoods.
Everything.
Genetically modified.
And with that, I see we have a caller. We're not going to jump to the caller yet. We're going to go to a quick break. Caller, please stay holding. We're going to come to you as soon as we come back. Again, you're listening to The Urban Cafe on WMNF 88.5.
Roman of the Urban Cafe, and I would like to take this time to thank those of you who have called into our show in the past. Now remember that we welcome your voice, and it's better to call earlier than later to ensure that your voice is heard. The number is 813-239-9663. We would love to hear from you.
Colors of Jazz, 6 to 9. Every Sunday evening, it's a WMNF tradition. Providing you with recorded jazz from the past, present, and future. This is America's original art form. Only on WMNF 88.5 and WMNF.org.
Welcome back.
Oh, yeah, man, how you doing? Come on, you good? Come on. I know you like that. Yeah,
go clear. Go clear. Go clear. She's in here doing that dance.
I love the energy she brings. This is great. So again, good morning. Buenos dias, Tampa Bay, St. Pete, Sarasota, Plant City, wherever you are. Tarpon Springs, Newport Richie, Port Richie.
Valrico. Good morning, the United States. We Brandon. Know you can hear us in Michigan and Wisconsin and Maine and California.
I have a friend that tunes in every weekend. We're not on Facebook. He actually tuned into my Facebook feed, but I have a friend who tunes in from South Africa.
Nice.
Law student. There's some.
Send us a note sometime.
There's some big changes. There's some big changes taking place in South Africa. I'm so excited.
We need to have a
let's not even
foreign
talk,
conversation.
Yeah,
talk
that's about a whole the other appointment. Show. That's another show
of the new, the new South African. That Trump recently appointed.
Yeah. The ambassador?
Yeah, the new U.S. ambassador.
I'm not familiar.
She's a purse designer.
Oh, fantastic.
Which makes sense for her.
Yeah, right? There's a lot of animals in Africa, and she might make some nice, elephant bag or
know.
Something.
I don't know.
All right, before I start laughing hysterically, we do have a caller on the call. Please state your name and where you're calling us from. Caller, you're on the air.
My name's Chris.
Chris?
Yeah.
Hey, good morning, Chris. How you doing?
Good morning, Chris, what's up?
Not so much. I was calling because This is the first time I've ever heard your show, so I don't know anybody's name, but they was just talking about the three-fifths compromise.
About the three-state compromise.
The three-fifths.
That was repealed with the 14th Amendment.
No. It was repealed, but the language is still on the I think it's the 13th Amendment.
Yeah,
where it states.
I understand that, but I also don't think the language should be taken out. That way, we know where it came from.
You're right. That is a good point, because part of understanding America is, and I strongly believe this, part of understanding and part of being an American is understanding our dark side and our light side, and you have to come to grips with it. In order for a person to say, yes, you know, you are my brother, you are my sister, you know, you have to know, instead of sweeping it under the rug to pretend like it never happened, you have to understand racism, you have to understand segregation, you have to understand slavery, you have to understand everything that has been done negatively in this country, and say, okay, now we're going to heal, we're going to move past this, we're going to make sure that it doesn't happen again. So that's a great point. I appreciate that.
That's all I had to say right now. I'm actually on a hands-free device on the interstate, so I just wanted to...
Keep tuning in.
We're here
every Sunday from 9 to 11.
Thank you, Chris, for tuning in
again to the Urban Cafe. Love to hear first-time listeners and
first-time listener. That's right.
Yeah. Absolutely. So my dad always jokes around. He says he's going to call in one day and say, long time, first time. So long time listener, first time. So we're going to jump to a call here in a second. But before we do that, I want to talk about, Chris had mentioned, as well as Prince, about the three-fifths. What is the three-fifths? So for our listeners out there who may not be familiar with the terminology, the three-fifths compromise was a compromise reached among state delegates during 1787 United States Constitutional Convention. So when they were coming up with the U.S. Constitution, they came up with something called the three-fifths compromise. What this does is it says how slaves would be counted when determining a state's total population for legislative representation and taxing purposes. So what this did is it basically every slave only counted for three-fifths of a person. And so that for until the 14th Amendment was passed, what year was the 14th Amendment was passed? Anybody know that?
The 14th Amendment.
Well, it was several centuries, two centuries at least before the 14th, or a century and a half, I believe, before the 14th Amendment was passed. But long story short, slaves in this country from the founding of this country, which was not 1776. It's very important that people understand that 1776 is when they declared independence, but they actually didn't become a country until 1787. And so, do you have the year?
No, I don't have the year. I have something that's kind of random, okay, but it makes sense. It relates to this, though.
Okay, so the three-fifths compromise, basically, it's in my opinion, a tarnish on America. Right. And I agree with Chris. I think it's important that we keep it in there so we knew where it's important for us to know where we came from and in order to know where we need to go.
1789.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I was wondering, so you're back in the 1800s. There's no calculators. Three-fifths, who is figuring out, okay, this state has so many people, we got to... That's crazy.
They could do the math, I'm pretty sure they probably rounded up, 1,000, and then they do three-fifths of that.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, it's very interesting I agree with the caller, Chris, that we should keep it in there, and then also understand that it's no longer the law. There's been another amendment that supersedes it and invalidates the three-fifth compromise. John actually found an answer to a question that we had earlier about the census. And so John emailed us from Port Richey. Thank you, John. Skipping a census question. So according to an article published in NPR in April of this year, refusing to answer any census question or intentionally giving a false answer to a question can result in a fine, according to federal law. I did not know that.
They haven't found me yet. I know they haven't found me.
It says here the article.
They haven't found me yet.
The article also states that returning an incomplete census questionnaire may lead to a phone call or an in-person visit to your home by workers from the Census Bureau.
Oh, see,
that, I wish they would.
So listen. Listen.
Yeah, yeah. Go to Nestor's house and see what he says.
The first time I did a census,
you'll
I lived
have
in
a party
Look,
so we can,
Claire, the first time I did a census, I lived in East New York, Brooklyn. I don't think anybody was coming to visit me over there.
Actually, for the 2010 census, more than 600,000 people were hired as door knockers to go from household to household. So, John, that is fantastic. And that's why
Thank you, John.
Yeah. That's why we listen to people are listening to the Urban Cafe so they can get information that they otherwise wouldn't hear about in any other form. You know, you don't hear CNN or MSNBC talking about these kind of things. You know, NPR did publish an article, but, you know, who would have heard about that?
For as long as we talk about it as well. You know, normally they give us like 10 seconds on something and move on.
Exactly.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh,
go ahead,
you know, this was crazy because, like, I'm reading here. Because, see, then you'll see ads come out that say that, oh, well, you'll be fine regarding the census, so don't answer it.
That's crazy. We have a caller on the air.
I want to continue with this real quick because see what's happening now is this is the good and bad of social media, because I'm reading here that there have been different I'm looking at the NPR news on April 19th. It says skipping the 2020 census citizenship question, you'll still be counted. So you're thinking, okay, I could still be counted, and as you gentlemen have said, you have not been followed, or no one's called out to you guys or reached out to you for not answering that question. Now, the funny thing is this. There have been, because of the citizenship questionnaire on there, there have been social media, different platforms, whether Facebook, Twitter, about we should boycott the census because they're asking the citizenship question. And I think you definitely don't want to do that, because then that's going to have you not be counted.
First and foremost, these kinds of things that be popping up on Facebook where they say we should do that, you really just should avoid that, because most of it is released from the folks who don't want you to do that in the first place.
A lot of people don't vote.
No. It's like, I don't want you to vote, so I'm going to release some viral thing, and I'm going to release it to a certain ethnic group and let them run with it. So, you know.
Okay, we got a caller.
So, yeah, we do have a caller, Claire. Mm-hmm. And so, caller, when you bring it, please state your name and where you're calling us from.
St. Petersburg, Florida.
And what was your name, sir?
Lito.
How you doing today, sir?
Wonderful.
Good morning.
Just to let you know, sir, we're at the end of the show, and so if you can make it your point a little quick so we can wrap this up.
I need for someone to explain to the listening audience what the Dred Scott decision is.
Dred Scott, if I'm not mistaken, Dred Scott was a situation where there was a gentleman who escaped from slavery and went to a state where there was considered no slavery, and he wanted to live out his life as a free slave. And then they came up with the Fugitive Slave Act, which allowed these posses to come up, and they went roving. They went searching for folks. And so they kidnapped Dred Scott, brought him back to his plantation owners, and he fought. He filed lawsuits stating that once he made it to a free state, that he was no longer considered a slave. And so that's a Dred Scott decision. I think it came out in 1789.
No, that 1857.
1857, yeah, 1857. Famous Dred Scott case.
Caller, did that address the question for you?
Thank you very much.
Okay. Awesome. Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much for calling us. And again, you're listening to the Urban Cafe on WMNF 88.5. We've had quite a wonderful show here today. Talked about the 14th Amendment.
So I know we're closing out, but I want to encourage everybody to listen to at least last week's episode of Duality of Sorts. And the reason I say that is because what I tried to push out there was us demanding and expecting more from our politicians. Mm-hmm. No matter who wins or loses, we should start rating our politicians by their ability to get things done, by their ability to work together and not apart. And that's what I'm encouraging with Duality of Sorts this week.
Tell everyone again where they can find your platforms.
Duality of Sorts, you can find, we do have a Facebook page, so you just type in Duality of Sorts, or you can go onto YouTube and do the same as well.
Okay, and thank you for that. And it's and I found the conversation very interesting. Thank you for bringing
it. I'd like to add one thing that Nestor mentioned. You know, there is a website that you can see how your representative votes on anything. So, you know, if you don't know what your representative's doing, check them out. All right. Go online and check it out.
Yep.
That's true. And so next weekend, we'll be on the air, Thanksgiving weekend. And so we have Dr. Marquita Wills with the Mental Health Corner talking about holiday blues. And then we're also going to have Jerome with the Health Corner talking about the flu shot. Jerome calls in from California every month, and we have a great conversation about that. And you're listening to The Urban Cafe on WMNF 88.5. Thank you to all our callers today, folks who have emailed us. We just really appreciate your feedback. It's been, we talked about the 14th Amendment, we've talked about the election results, we talked about Jamal Khashoggi, and so it's been a very interesting conversation, and I can't thank you all enough. Thank you to everybody here, Claire, Joe, Jamal, to Wallace. Yep. Mr. Ortiz. And
thank you for calling
and
in.
Prince, thank you all so much for calling in. And with that, we're going to hand it off to NPR News.
Have all a right. great
thank
day.
Thank you, folks. Thank you so much for calling
in. WMNF 88.5 Tampa. Nobody.